Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
A new group within the DOD seeks to track how well technology makes its way to troops. Heidi Shu, the Undersecretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, says it will use advanced data analytics to do so. The group is called Transition Tracking Action Group, or TTAG. Joining me with the details, the DOD's Chief Data Officer for Research and Engineering, Cyrus Jabari. Mr. Jabari, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Well, first of all, tell us, TTAG, what is this all about and what problem is it trying to solve?
The Transition Tracking Action Group, or the TTAG, is all about enhancing the department's visibility on its investments using data analytics, breaking data silos and unifying them together in novel ways so that we could have better insight over what we are doing, what we have invested in, and therefore oversight.
And when you say invested in, you mean what exactly? What areas of investment do you look at?
A number of different types of technology investments. So the department prioritizes 14 critical technology areas. That's been a key focus for us to get a better handle of how are we roadmapping for those 14 critical technology areas and what are things that are in the pipeline that we are developing or that we could take from the commercial sector. What the Transition Tracking Action Group cares about, though, is the whole wealth of technology investments from research and engineering to acquisition that exist along that life cycle that we could better observe, better get a hold of, and better bring to the warfighter or to the field.
What are some of those critical technologies? You mean like directed energy, artificial intelligence?
Yes, that's exactly right. Of the 14 critical technology areas, Heidi Shu's vision for technology competition says that there are these quote-unquote seed areas of emerging technology. Think biotechnology, quantum, and so forth. Then there are these more commercially adopted technology areas that we prioritize, such as trusted artificial intelligence and autonomy, or advanced computing and software. And then there are more defense-specific critical technology areas like hypersonics, directed energy, the ones you alluded to. So those are the critical technology areas that we prioritize, but we don't just want to get greater fidelity on the critical technology areas. There are other technology areas that the department prioritizes. Think in the Navy, for example, naval power or maritime systems. In the Army, soldier mobility or lethality. And then obviously with the announcement of the Replicator Initiative, we have niche combinations of technologies such as what Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks announced. The focus for Replicator in this first tranche will be on what are called all-domain autonomous attritable or ADA2 technologies. We want to get a better grapple of across research, engineering, and acquisitions and throughout the defense innovation ecosystem, what is in the pipeline and how can we better leverage it?
Right. So what is the impediment to understanding the total picture now?
I think within any large organization, as you would see across industries, we are discovering that there is a huge need to get data outside of the data silos that they exist in. There's been a significant move within the Department of Defense to be responsive to Congress to make sure that we could at least get a greater hold of our financial data. And we've made significant strides since at least 2018 when the department established its first universe of transactions through the Advancing Analytics, otherwise known as ADVANA, Enterprise Data Analytics Platform, where we unified all of the different general ledger accounting systems across DOD and had them talk to each other so we could create a common financial operating picture with great fidelity and near real-time visibility. And so since that innovation within DOD, there's been a lot of work from the battlefield to the boardroom to break data silos. The TTAG is trying to focus on something that is of common interest, not only within the department's research and engineering and acquisition and requirements communities, but also to Congress and the common taxpayer when they want to make sure that we could answer questions on what is in the Valley of Death or what made it across the Valley of Death and how efficient are we being in tracking those things across or within those valleys.
We're speaking with Cyrus Jabari. He's the Chief Data Officer for Research and Engineering at the Defense Department. And I guess this is also a way that you can avoid duplication of investments or, you know, one company getting money for the same thing from two different far-flung pieces of DOD. Not that that could ever happen.
Well, I think that with any greater insights, very wise senior leader actually coined the term, at least to me for the first time, that with greater insight, you can provide greater oversight. These are things that our leadership says should have been or could have been perhaps prioritized to answer these age-old questions that it sounds like TTAG is trying to address right now. Tracking technology transitions, as you know, is not something that has just sprung up in the year 2024. That interest has existed for decades. So we want to, using the novel innovations in tools, in policy and process changes that have been taking place in the past few years, want to capitalize on that, break data silos so that we could provide greater insight and therefore support better oversight.
Right. So besides oversight and accountability, which you have to have, though, is there an element of making sure that, golly, this technology has so much promise, why isn't it productized quicker? Why isn't it turning into an acquisition and getting it into the troops' hands, so to speak, which is the ultimate goal of all of this?
That's exactly right. So it's setting us up to get better insights into the investments we make and the products that make it to the warfighter or have not yet made it to the warfighter or could make it to the warfighter based on the requirements that we understand, those requirements generated by the end users, the warfighters, the combatant commands, etc. It's also laying the groundwork, though, for us to understand and capitalize on our impact in economic security and economic growth. Through TTAG, we'll get greater insights into the investments that we have made that ended up into the commercial sector, that ended up being productized, and see our contributions to the commercial sector and private capital spaces. But better yet, it will be incredible to see insights such as those things that we initially invested in and were productized that we ended up buying on the back end and delivering to the warfighter. I'm very excited to see more information from those outputs.
And how does TTAG itself work? I mean, is there a room somewhere in the Pentagon that has a name TTAG on it now? And who comprises TTAG? And who do you matrix with to get the information in and back out?
So TTAG, although formally established this past month, has actually been in the works in an informal capacity for about 2 years. Really, the background for what generated this was in May of 2021, Deputy Secretary of Defense Kathleen Hicks announced the launch of an Innovation Steering Group. And the Innovation Steering Group, or ISG, one of its main lines of efforts was to map this defense innovation ecosystem that everybody talks about, that you see being mapped in, I think, academic and commercial spaces. We wanted to get a greater handle of when we say the word innovation, what do we mean, and who is actually executing work in support of that. In relation to the mapping of the defense innovation ecosystem, which I was very happy to support when it was first announced, we also noticed that everybody talks about technology transition, but we have different definitions for what transition means or what a technology even means. So I was thrilled to support the first ever standardized definition of technology transitions and technology transition pathways that was codified in a joint memorandum from Honorable Heidi Shu, our Chief Technology Officer, in conjunction with the Undersecretary for Acquisition and Sustainment, Honorable Bill LaPlante, and then Undersecretary for Policy, Colin Call. That memorandum was issued in April 2022, and as a data nerd, that helped me have a common lexicon where we could then start to search for and tag technology transitions. In the past year and a half since, we've been building out advanced analytics prototypes or pilots where within seconds, for example, for the first time ever, we can actually track the number of new entrants into the defense innovation ecosystem through research, development, test, and evaluation dollars and see that within the past 3 years, it's actually increased by 62%. or we can track small business innovation research, small business technology transfer transitions, which get a lot of commentary externally within seconds, again, through these prototypes. In addition to prototyping out solutions through unique data connections that we've built and demonstrated back to what was the innovation steering group and community of interest within the department trying to attack this problem, we also created the informal transition tracking action group, which was tasked to develop an initial set of recommendations in an implementation plan that would get the most senior leader sign-off from the Deputy Secretary of Defense to the Secretary of Army, Navy, Air Force, the undersecretary leaders within the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and the chairman or vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff on what is the first attack we could make in breaking data silos, unifying data, and for the first time ever, getting a tranche of data that tracks technology transitions as described earlier. That implementation plan is actually finalized. We are in our final moments of receiving approval, hopefully, and I look forward to keeping you updated on what we decide to do. But yes, TTAG is going to continue to prototype data analytics solutions and consider policy and process recommendations that need to address key data sets.
And by the way, that definition of transition, does that encompass the idea of not transitioning from research to a prototype, but transitioning into something, again, in a warfighter's arsenal or tool set that's actually deployable and useful for the mission?
Yes, we want to emphasize the importance of tracking things that make it to the field to demonstrate our return on investment. Absolutely.
So if you haven't crossed the valley of death with it, then it hasn't transitioned really.
Well, I think in a more meta sense, as described by, say, the Office of Strategic Capital, for example, there is not just one valley of death, but there are different valleys of death or stages that a idea needs to cross from lab to prototype, from prototype to product, and product to scale. And so you could think of something being in the field as that scale moment, that end state. We want to track across those valleys, within the valleys, but also across those different iterative steps, because that helps us then connect a technology solution, ideally, and its owner or its performer within the department to the next stage that could Sherpa it across the valleys.
And your job as chief data officer then is to help people choose the right data that has to be combined to get the answer they want from different systems throughout DOD.
Yes, this is one of the most exciting parts of the digital transformation journey that I've seen in DOD. Because as we've developed those prototypes that I alluded to, we're seeing them being heavily integrated within common business processes that did not exist before. And so hopefully when we get this massive shift in transitions data and analytics, we will be able to enable the technology officer, the chief technology officer, and the various technology officers, end users, acquirers across DOD, and even researchers to see what's in the wild and what's maybe missing.
Cyrus Jabari is the chief data officer for research and engineering at the Defense Department. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Tom.
And we'll post this interview along with more information about TTAG at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected. And also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective. We get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Yeah, excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down. So I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role, and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career, and that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. You're, Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, yeah. And worked alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.